Take us to a new direction, talking mostly about tobacco, but talking about the need for those of us who are in the public health field and working on policy to really think about how we compete in the policy arena. Dr. Malone is probably familiar to many of you. She has done a lot of research and is known internationally for her work on tobacco control and looking into more of the evidence from the Master Settlement Agreement and the tobacco documents that were released and made available as part of that agreement. And I would like to introduce her as our final speaker for this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to really, this is to some degree, it's a work in progress, and it's kind of a more conceptual thought piece that we've been working on. We're working on a paper on this. But thinking about public health as an industry competitor, in this case, tobacco industry competitor, I have nothing to disclose other than that I own one share each of Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Companies for research and advocacy purposes. But that doesn't rise to the level of disclosure here. I want to just acknowledge my research group with whom we've had many productive conversations around this area, and this is sort of an ongoing group thought project, really. So as Linda said, since really 1998, I've been studying the tobacco industry's internal documents, and I know many of you in other fields are envious of us in tobacco because we have all these millions of pages of documents that are archived on the Legacy Tobacco Documents Library and were released as a result of all the state attorneys general lawsuits in the 1990s. They are continuing to be released, although, of course, they're somewhat more careful now about what they put down on paper than they once were. But they are a rich trove of information, and not just about the tobacco industry, but about other industries, although, of course, much less about the other industries. UCSF also has some archives of pharmaceutical industry documents, and chemical industry documents are also available on some websites. So there are getting to be some caches of these. One of the things that I want to start off by talking about is what tobacco companies call the anti-tobacco industry. This is a document from one of these documents that we study, talking about the focus of ATI organizations. Well, ATI organizations, that's the anti-tobacco industry, and you see they include names like the American Cancer Society, the American College of Chest Physicians, and so forth. So we are all, I hope, in this room, part of the anti-tobacco industry, unless you're here as a representative of the industry, which some of you probably are, since you usually show up at meetings. Organizations that they identified as clearly having opposing interests included the WHO. So I think this is a profound thing to think about. This is an entire transnational industry that sees the WHO as having clearly opposing interests. That really tells us what we're dealing with here. And so we started thinking about it, and we started thinking, okay, if you're going to call it an anti-tobacco industry, that suggests that there is competition going on, that we need to be aware of this competition. And so we started thinking, in what markets are we competing? We're not trying to sell tobacco, so we're not competing in the market for tobacco. We're competing in a different market, and that market is the market for the social acceptability of tobacco use. And as this document observed, the lack of social acceptability may prove our biggest challenge. I think we're also competing, and these are all related, in markets for legitimacy, and that is this idea of being legal and acceptable and okay, for authority, responsibility for an area, and the right to control what society is going to do about a particular area, and ethical voice, in terms of who really is able to speak about what's right and wrong about whatever this product is. And I think this applies outside of tobacco as well. So if we're competing, so if we take the premise that, in fact, we are competing with this industry but in a different market, how do companies try to defeat their competitors? Well, they seek competitive intelligence about those against whom they're trying to compete. they do corporate branding and rebranding. In this case, I'm saying corporate branding because we're not talking about tobacco marketing. We're talking about marketing the industry against the anti-tobacco industry. They try to divide and conquer their competitors. They attack their competitors directly or using others. And they try to dominate or control the market or the general political and regulatory environment. So drawing on some of these documents that we've studied over the years and published about in different ways, I'm going to offer some illustrations of each of these. Competitive intelligence was actually the first thing that I ever published a documents paper about. But we later went on to discover that the tobacco companies had a long series of cross-company, where they worked together, international intelligence gathering operations. It's really a fairly amazing thing that this has been going on, and I'm sure it's still going on, and it's probably going on in these other industries as well. But their point is to gather intelligence about their opponents. In this case, they were working on primarily on countering secondhand smoke science and the people who were doing it. ICOSI, which was one of these organizations, the International Committee on Smoking Issues, was an anti-smoking had an anti-smoking organization's project, and a quote from one of their documents: "The practical application of this research will be papers that can be published and quoted to undermine the propaganda of anti-smoking groups by showing that they have self-serving ends." They're always very holier than thou, these industry people. In terms of corporate branding and rebranding, we published a paper on this as well. Sunrise was one of a series of corporate repositioning projects undertaken by Philip Morris, but other companies have also undertaken these to reinvent themselves as, in this case, sort of the new public health tobacco company, the new kinder, gentler, friendly tobacco company, the new altruistic company, which, as many of you know, Altria is now the parent of Philip Morris, used to be Philip Morris, is now Altria. This corporate branding and rebranding has a real role to play. And so you do see these corporate ads. They're not ads for products. They're ads for corporations. And this is why they do it. When the advertising works, it gives consumers a reason to compartmentalize their feelings about Philip Morris. So in this case, to say, well, yeah, they do sell the single most deadly consumer product ever made, but on the other hand, they're so nice, and they help little old ladies across the street, and they give money to food banks. And so, you know, we'll just look at that side. And so this is another example from their website. This is actually a little older piece from their website, but, you know, where they're talking about how can we be committed to preventing kids from using tobacco products. Well, some people may think it's contradictory, but we don't see a contradiction. So they are just all about the kids. Counterbranding, however, is really still the exception in the anti-tobacco industry, isn't it? We do see the single most effective youth campaign of all time, youth smoking prevention campaign, which was the Truth campaign. This is a badly captured example from their famous body bag ad, where youth piled up body bags outside of the Philip Morris headquarters, or a tobacco company headquarters in New York City. Very effective counterbranding ad that really called out the tobacco industry. Another technique, divide and conquer. This is from our Sunrise Project paper. They were focusing on repositioning themselves as the tobacco company seeking reasonable solutions to complex problems. And anytime they put things in quotation marks like that, you know that's not exactly what they mean. But this is important. They wanted to enhance internal conflicts within the tobacco control movement and possibly encourage some new ones. And they had this whole Machiavellian plan about how to do this. But this is something you really have to be aware of in any industry that you're working against. Attacking competitors directly or through intermediaries, just some examples of how they do it. The nanny state, everybody has heard about the nanny state. Threats to civil rights and free speech, as has already been mentioned. Accusing the anti-tobacco industry of acting only in self-interest. Accusing public health of misusing resources or illegal lobbying, misplaced priorities, etc. One of my favorite documents about this that I just keep having to show is this Children and Smoking, the Balanced View. Now, this was produced by one of those intelligence organizations, InfoTap, back in the 90s. And I just love this one. This was an attack on the WHO, saying, well, there's still all these unanswered questions. This is 1990, and they're saying scientific evidence has not conclusively established cigarette smoking as a causative agent in the development of disease. And WHO should be looking over here at malaria, dysentery. Or as I like to quote from the great title of a paper by Mark Nichter from some years back, Saving the Children for the Tobacco Industry. Dominating the market and the regulatory environment. We published a paper on how tobacco companies use corporate philanthropy as a proxy for lobbying. This was from a document from Philip Morris, A Simplified Model of a Legislator's World. How do you influence a legislator? And one of the really interesting things is down here in this left lower corner, there are pet causes and charities. So they actually would research who the favorite charities were of the legislators so they could get themselves invited to the same events, because legislators love to go and get their picture taken with good causes. And they would also do the same thing for their spouse. So they would actually have these opportunities to rub shoulders at these fundraising things and check presentation ceremonies and build good relationships in this way. And this is how this works. This is from a very old document that we uncovered when we were working on philanthropy in the African American community. It's like a savings account. One has to keep on making deposits into the savings account, goodwill, deposits of getting to know people, listening to their problems, gently bringing them along. And you make those deposits into the savings account so that when you have to make a withdrawal, the bank balance is there. Mm-hmm. And that's the expectation. You aren't getting this money for free. Someday we're going to ask for that withdrawal. Another way they control the regulatory environment is through programs like WeCard. How many of you have seen these stickers? They tend to be ubiquitous on stores. This is actually an industry-initiated program that we found through the documents was actually developed to reduce the number of sting operations on retailers and to build these partnerships with public health. So if anybody's in a partnership on the WeCard deal, please remove yourselves. And the other purpose of WeCard was actually it had a separate purpose as a counter-branding. It was also trying to undermine the Truth campaign, which was really being effective at this time. And as this document says, these commercials were positive influence on the attitudes toward Philip Morris, and exposure to the ad greatly helped in the sale of the responsible marketing only to adults message, which was and reducing positive response to ads vilifying the company, and that's what they called the Truth ads. The overall aim of all of this, to create doubt. And we found documents from a speaking tour that they made in the late 90s talking about, some of you may doubt us. You might be a little suspicious that we've suddenly decided to come out of our shell, as though they were ever in a shell. But please don't close your eyes to this possibility that we're really trying to be part of the solution. But the fact is, this really harkens back to the infamous Doubt is Our Product memo, and for those of you not in tobacco control, this was a famous memo in which they were trying to counter the evidence that tobacco caused disease by saying doubt is our product, since it's the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the mind of the public. So how does this contribute to what we're doing? Well, we already know that we want to denormalize smoking, but if we understand ourselves as an industry competitor, then we have to move to industry denormalization as a key part of what we are up to in tobacco control. And that means industry-focused media and advocacy campaigns, isolating the industry, and industry-focused policy change. And this would hold true for others as well. This is part of tobacco industry denormalization, which is themes, campaigns, and perspectives aiming toward reversing the process of industry normalization promoted by the cigarette manufacturers for decades. It's all been normalized. We've all come to accept it as taken for granted. We have to reverse that. So the Truth Campaign was really one of the first examples of doing that. Our brand, their brand is lies, our brand is truth. Those are body bags there on the Marlboro Man's companions' horses. California has made this a key part of its program. Cigarette companies making a killing off you. And there's considerable evidence that this works. It's associated with reduced smoking prevalence, initiation risk, reduced intention to smoke, and increased intention to quit. I'm getting the sign. But I just have to say the public is ahead of us on this. My last slide. 68% of the public, according to Philip Morris's own public opinion data in 2004, wished there was a way to eliminate cigarettes. 62% said all advertising should be banned, and well over half said the right thing, responsible thing to do for a cigarette company would be to go out of business. So they're there already. We just need to catch up with the public. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank the panel, and I want to thank everybody. There's a couple open spots here, but thanks for all of you who are standing and sitting on the floor in the back of the room. I apologize that we don't have enough space, but it's great to see that we have that much interest. As you can see, we had a quite a nice continuum of everything from local policy and community engagement at that level to the big picture of what's going on trans globally. So. I think it was a great opportunity to see the connection and the connection between different types of substances that we deal with across food, alcohol, tobacco, and prescription drugs. So we'd love the chance now to open it up to some questions. So, yes, and I'm going to need to repeat your questions so that it gets into the recording. So if you can keep them kind of brief and make them questions in that statement, that'd be great.
It's a real question. The first presentation is Pratt. Said the retailers were very much opposed. What were some of the reasons they gave for being so adamantly opposed to the program?
Okay, the question is, what were some of the reasons that retailers were opposed? What were some of the reasons they gave? And Linda, you'll need to...
Farmers and retailers?
Yes, thank you. And you'll need to... It's this one. It's not that one. No, you have to stand up here to get it recorded. So, sorry. The main objections were, the first thing they said was liability, that the there's no system for taking back. In fact, it's the federal government. I mean, law enforcement is the only entity able to take back controlled substances, so they felt that they would be, you know, open themselves up to liability. The second thing was that they don't have personnel, and they don't want to spend the money to have personnel be involved in taking back the medications. Those were the two main concerns.
I have a similar question. Is what about, wouldn't that be resolved by putting a container there that would be emptied out on a regular basis by the police, and therefore all the pharmacy would be doing would be providing a space for a depository?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
Wouldn't that be resolved by having a separate container for controlled substances next to the bin?
And that the police
would then come and dispose of the controlled substances. Well, actually, the way we resolved it is by having a poster on the bins that says no controlled substances allowed. Yeah, and we do know that there are controlled substances coming in, but they all go to the same place. So. Sorry, I know the logistics seem a little awkward, but to get the recording for the essential learning piece, we have to actually talk into a little thing here you can't all see. So, yes?
I guess I have a similar question for Linda, because how does the local ordinance compare to the state and federal laws restricting who does take medications back? I know that, you know, the DEA has been involved with the take-back programs because they originally were the only ones that could take it back, and now it's being transferred to law enforcement, but there are some restrictions around there, so I just wondered will the ordinance fail to stand up to federal regulations that are around it?
And the question is, how does the Alameda County ordinance compare with some of the federal laws?
As you may know, that the federal law that it requires that only law enforcement collect controlled substances has been changed. President Obama passed that law about a year and a half ago. We're still waiting for the regulations to come out on that. And the ordinance is set up to be somewhat flexible to address that. We're phasing in prescription drugs as the first level of drugs that we are collecting, and controlled substances we're waiting on what that legislation, the regulations turn out to be.
Yes, in the back.
So, for the last speaker, would you advocate really becoming the ATA and adopting those tactics and strategies, or do you think there's a better way, especially given the imbalance of budget?
The question is, I'm going to let you repeat it.
Okay, I think the question is, would I advocate becoming the ATI? Yes, I am advocating becoming the ATI. It's not that I don't think we need to keep doing things that we are already doing, like having smoke-free laws and that sort of thing that definitely help us move this direction. But I think ultimately we have to figure out what we're going to do about this industry. You know, it's just going to be a war of attrition if we keep this up. So at some point and there is a lot of very interesting discussions going on now in the tobacco control movement about an end game for tobacco and what that looks like. And part of what that looks like is thinking about, can we really continue to afford to have an industry that is aggressively, promoting the most deadly product ever made, consumer product ever made? So I think it's a reasonable question. I mean, there are other industries. Robert Proctor has talked about this in his book, Golden Holocaust. There are other industries that we've phased out. Asbestos is one. Of course, people weren't addicted to asbestos, except the people that were making money off of it. But I do think that it is a conversation we have to start to have of where we're going to go. And I think public health has to be taking the lead on that in terms of what we're going to do with this industry.
In the room.
It was very interesting. Richard Jackson was talking about how the tobacco industry's tactic has been moved into the climate global warming argument. And one of the reasons why corporations are able to do that, I think, is because they, I forget the term, but you know, they expand their businesses to various levels. In terms of the anti-tobacco industry, how can we learn across, even beyond our alcohol, tobacco, and nutrition here, how can we as a field begin to take advantage of that knowledge that you have in tobacco and so on, and work across in a synergistic way to maybe it has to do with something like Larry Wallach and Lakoff are talking about, that the issue is larger. What do you have to say about framing and how do we go as a field, not just in a particular area?
Well, I mean, I think, and Michelle probably, I can tell Michelle is bursting to say something, so I won't hog all the time, but I think one piece is, we have to reinvent the role of citizens as opposed to the role of consumers. The role of consumers, I love you, Ralph Nader, but I'm sorry, the role of consumers is a very empty role for people. And we have to talk about citizens and whether this is right to have these organizations with such power in society, so outpacing the power of ordinary people. And I think that's part of the conversation. It's a very political one.
And Michelle. Okay. So I agree with what Ruth just said. I want to, though, put the onus on all of us here, 11,000 public health professionals. You know, we have a responsibility to stop thinking about public health in the old way, right, which is, frankly, largely about individual behavior change and education. That model is so yesterday. We have proven over decades of time that it's been a dismal failure, and we need to acknowledge that as a public health profession. Step two, after acknowledging that we have a problem, is to see I'm just making this up as I go along, but to see these connections, like I said earlier, and it goes to the teaching in public health. I was blown away, I won't
go too long, but I'm really passionate about this. I didn't learn a damn thing about nutrition at the Yale School of Public Health, okay, which is pretty mind-blowing given, and this is only in the late 90s, it wasn't that long ago. And because as I learned it, there are certain, requirements that public health schools, hoops to have to jump through. Well, how about we require the public health schools talk about the role of corporations, right? We talk about vectors and all this, fancy schmancy words. Corporations are causing the leading causes of death in this country. What's that famous paper, the guys who wrote Actual Causes of Death, right? Right, we need to get a new version. You know what I'm talking about, MOCDAD, right? So that was when we had this revelation in public health that it wasn't that we were dying of lung cancer, we were dying of smoking. Okay, great. Okay, we did that, fine. Now we need to say we're not dying of cancer, we're dying of Philip Morris, right? So it's about changing our paradigm, the way we think, the way we talk about these issues, pointing the finger at the right place, not just going upstream and not just talking about environmental causes. Frankly, I'm tired of hearing about environmental causes, right? It's the corporations that are killing people, and that's what we need to talk about.
Okay, hang on. All right, it's so exciting. Oh, my goodness. I
wish there was some enthusiasm.
I can't stand it. I mean, seriously, I would just add to everything that I totally agree with what Michelle just said, with the fact that we have to stop the silos. We have to stop working in our tobacco and alcohol and food and pharmaceutical and whatever else, little areas, big areas that we've all acquired so much expertise and so much experience in, but where are we for each other? And I'm speaking as a personal, individual public health advocate, but also as our professional areas of expertise when the initiatives come out, when the corporations are doing the damage, when we see this business going on, where are we? And where is our alcohol or tobacco or whatever else field? This feels like such a revelation to have the four of us here and all of you here, and I just hope that it can continue in future meetings and future section work.
Yeah, a great question. This is about the role of the FDA in changing the game around tobacco and the concern that the tobacco industry seems to be awfully cozy there, which I think a lot of us are seeing and have concerns about. I think my personal opinion is that the great potential of the FDA legislation lies with states and possibly even with city governments, because those governments can actually enact stronger legislation in certain areas. And to the degree that they begin to do that, even if they face legal challenges by the industry, the media attention to that will only help this cause. So I do think there's potential there. I think it's fairly untapped as yet. But for example, as Robert Proctor has pointed out, states or cities can actually ban sale of a product. So they could actually say, we're not selling cigarettes anymore. One town, I think in New York, tried to do that, were sued, of course, quickly, and backed off because they couldn't afford it. But imagine if you had 50 or 100 towns doing that. They might all have to back off. But the media coverage of that would start to really raise the issue as something bigger that people were talking about and asking about and thinking about. And that's part of where we have to go, I think. I just wanted to make an announcement because somebody thrust this into my hand. At 4 o'clock today in Golden Gate B, there is a session on identifying multiple sites for policy intervention. And this is, again, looking across across areas of public health at industry activities, so that may be something that will be of interest to some of the people in this room. That's session 3312. So
have a question. Yes.
A question about processed. Of course, the industry has much more strength than what our, in respect to money and in respect to communication, than the ATI. And I was wondering to what extent the ATIs might compensate for these by using multiple sources, multiple small sources, and multiple means of communication, including communication online, use of blogs and the web, things like, for instance, Nick Fuldenberg's blog on corporations. So this might be a possible. The question I'm raising is how do we investigate the process by which you could strengthen the role of the ATI?
I don't know who wants to address this, but the question refers to the big disparity of resources that industries have compared to those of us in public health that are trying to control some of the impact of that. And are there some alternatives?
As to where you might look for money?
Yeah, way to look for money. good question. So there are so many problems with the way we fund public health, it's hard to know where to begin. Frankly, I know there's some researchers in the room, they're going to hate me for this, but we don't really need much more research. I don't want to say no more, but we don't need much more research when it comes to the major chronic diseases that we know are caused by lifestyle choices. So tobacco, alcohol, food. We've got the research. We know this is a problem, right? So you know, there's a mountain of money available just from research dollars, potentially. I know that researchers are going to say no, but I'm just saying, like, let's funnel some of the research money into advocacy, right? Foundations, funding all the wrong things, you know, where to even begin with foundations. So, you know, research coming from government dollars, it's all political, right? I mean, it really all comes down to politics. Alcohol used to be much more funded, you know, it almost all went away. I mean, Alcohol Justice is like the only national group left standing, right, because they have perpetual funding. We have no, this, the field is bankrupt. You know, this is a huge problem. And then the groups that are funded in food, which, you know, frankly, I'm making more money in the food policy realm. But even there's not enough money going to the political organizations, groups like Corporate Accountability International, who's here, has a booth that's going after the corporations. So the government tax, government funding, foundation money, and individual donation dollars. So Corporate Accountability, how are you mostly funded, right? Individual donations. And they are all staffed with doing fundraising, by the way. The groups I know that are most effective are getting most of their money from individuals and donations, not government and not foundations. So it's really building a political movement by, you know, making sure that people understand that we need money to go into advocacy. The food world is so not there. Prop 37, just to talk about that again for a minute, is so broken. The Yes campaign, because the groups aren't aligned together, right? We need to come together. We're not doing that.
I just wanted to add a little something to that, though, and this sort of speaks to your question as far as social media. Part of this is changing how we think. Part of this is changing how we talk about things. I mean, I remember raising some of these issues at APHA maybe 12, 14 years ago, and everybody looked at me like I had two heads. It was like you couldn't really say this. You know, it was sort of embarrassing to actually talk about corporations because this is our whole culture. But that's what we have to get our arms around. We're talking about a culture shift here. That we may not end up throwing out capitalism altogether and running down, you know, the Marxist path, but I do think there is something to be said for a saner form in which we really have some control over these enormous institutions. And frankly, I agree with what you're saying, Michelle, as far as research funding, but I think the other piece is the research needs to be differently oriented.
Corporate research I like.
Oh, well, okay. So just fund me. Yeah. I like that.
Corporate research. We don't need your,
but we need more research on the effects of these giant institutions on health. That's part of what we need to demand. We need to say, we need to prioritize this. This is clearly a major cause. So. Yeah.
Well, I would really like to thank the panel. We have wrapped up on time. I'm sure they will entertain some discussion and questions after we close, but we do need to make room for the next group that will be coming in. I want to thank everybody for coming, especially those of you who had to camp out on the floor or stand in the back. And let's give our speakers another round of applause to thank them.